industry headlines. A coalition of rights groups call on the new U.S. administration to address a dramatic deterioration in Bahrain's rights record. The U.S. pledges unwavering commitment to Israel after the International Criminal Court said it will investigate Israeli war crimes in the Palestinian territories. Also ahead, UN human rights experts warned that unilateral sanctions by the United States are resulting in severe human rights violations. Our top story, a coalition of human rights groups has urged the United States to address what they call a dramatic deterioration in Bahrain's rights record. 15 groups, including Amnesty International and the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, made the call in a letter to the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. They said Bahrain, emboldened by the former U.S. President Donald Trump's disregard for human rights, has intensified the crackdown on dissent to an unprecedented level. Manama has responded to a popular uprising that began in 2011 with an iron fist. The Al Khalifa regime has detained rights campaigners, broken up major opposition political parties, and revoked the nationality of several pro-democracy activists. The regime has also arrested, injured, and killed thousands of people. Rights activist Ras al-Najm says things have only become worse for the Bahraini people during the years as the Al Khalifa regime ruthlessly crushes dissidents.
Pretty much now they feel like they're successful because the people there are not really rising up anymore that much, and the movement hasn't, reignited again, because I guess the people don't want their family members to be attacked, because we've seen the Bahrain regime has no mercy. They attack women, they rape women, they attack kids, they go in houses at nighttime and they hit with tear gas and the automatic weapons. They have mercenaries from different countries that are hired, that are given citizenships as well. I mean, so I don't see any positive changes from the Bahrain regime at all. I mean, the people are more quiet, not because they don't want to stand up. It's just because they are trying to keep their families out of the suffering and misery. And that's the reason the Bahrainis, they want change still. They haven't gave up, and they're not submissive as well. That inside of them, they are just, really wounded, and they want to do something, but they're trying to wait for the right time maybe to reignite, and hopefully that will happen if nothing is done by human rights organizations, the United Nations, and all these international key players.
Former partner of assassinated Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has called on a Turkish court to consider a recent CIA report as evidence and hold the Saudi Crown Prince responsible for the killing.
We filed a request. We will follow up the process with the lawyers. The report that was published puts responsibility directly on the Crown Prince. In this regard, I request that this is included in the court process here.
Cengiz made the request after a trial session on Khashoggi's killing in Istanbul. The trial was held in absentia of 20 Saudi suspects, including two former aides to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Last week, the United States declassified an intelligence report that publicly accused bin Salman of approving Khashoggi's murder in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in 2018. Despite the revelation, Washington stopped short of applying sanctions on the Saudi Crown Prince. Yemeni people have called on the United Nations to stop begging donor countries for further aid under their name. Instead, they urged the world body to take actual steps to stop the Saudi-led war and lift the blockade imposed on the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more in this report.
$1.7 billion was pledged in the latest UN donor conference for Yemen, which is less than half of what was targeted. The United Nations described the pledges as disappointing. Yemeni people say they don't want the UN to continue begging for aid, but rather they want the Saudi-led war to be ended and the blockade lifted.
We said that we do not need any humanitarian support. They only have to stop the war and lift the siege on Yemen. And the Yemenis, with their capabilities and resources, can obtain their basic needs. Yet this conference came to glorify the countries participating in the war on Yemen and present them as a country supporting humanitarian work.
Human rights activists say the UN seeks to fulfill its programs through such campaigns, since what reaches the people in need is much less than what it spends as operational expenses for its local organizations.
The donors' conference is an attempt to cover the UN failure in managing humanitarian aid that has caused an increase in the need as well as the money that is gained. It's not aimed at covering the real need in Yemen, but rather to ensure the continuity of the work of the UN organizations, where about 70% of these insufficient funds are spent as operational expenses for organizations' programs.
According to the United Nations, Yemenis are experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis since the beginning of 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on the impoverished country.
Yemenis say the UN campaigns and initiatives are useless unless they are associated with real steps to stop the ongoing war and the blockade on Yemen that have led to the death of tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and is still going on. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. administration has underlined its opposition to the International Criminal Court's decision to open a formal investigation into Israeli war crimes against the Palestinians. The stance was highlighted in a phone call between U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Harris also underscored the, quote, unwavering U.S. commitment to Israel. The ICC launched its probe into Israeli war crimes after ruling that it has jurisdiction over occupied Palestinian territories. The move has been welcomed by human rights organizations, including Amnesty International. The focus of the inquiry will be the Israeli military offensive during the 2014 war on Gaza, as well as the regime's settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. UN human rights experts have warned that U.S. emergency declarations authorizing unilateral sanctions are leading to serious human rights violations. The experts said the bans violate a wide range of human rights, not only in targeted countries such as Iran, China, Russia, Syria, and Venezuela, but also elsewhere across the world. They added that the coercive measures breach rights to freedom of movement and association, as well as economic and social rights and the very right to life. The UN experts stressed that U.S. emergencies often last years or even decades, and so do the sanctions they authorize. They noted that the declarations appear to be excuses to impose the measures indefinitely instead of being true emergencies. The U.S. has beefed up security around the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. amid the warning of a possible militia attack on the Congress building. The Capitol compound remains surrounded with temporary fencing topped with razor wire. Some 5,000 National Guard troops also remain on site and around the city. Police were warned that a militia group of pro-Trump conspiracy theorists might try to attack the building on Thursday. The House also changed its schedule so that the chamber will not be in session due to security concerns. Some conspiracy theorists believe that former President Donald Trump can reclaim power on March the 4th. In early January, Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building to try to stop Congress from certifying President Joe Biden's electoral victory. Former CIA officer John Kiriakou says right-wing militias pose a serious threat to the safety of Americans, as they are very ideological and also well-armed.
You know, at the very end of the Obama administration, the FBI warned us that these right-wing militias, these militias that were popping up mostly in the Midwest and in the Western states, were dangerous and posed a threat to the safety of Americans. The FBI's conclusions were dismissed as being over the top. As it turns out, those conclusions were correct. These militia groups are very ideological, they are extremely right-wing, and they're very well-armed. And so I think there really is a threat to stability here in the Capitol. The FBI director said yesterday that that he believed the threat was specific and that it was against Democratic lawmakers on Capitol Hill. So all events are canceled in the Capitol today. And those troops and extra police are going to remain just in case these militia members decide to come to Washington and begin to incite violence.
The United States, meanwhile, the House of Representatives has passed a police reform package aimed at preventing violence against minority communities.
I know that change is difficult, but I believe fundamentally that police officers don't want to work in an environment where the culture says if they are to step up, if they are to say anything, if an officer is abusive or as an officer is corrupt, then their very lives could be in danger. So one of the goals of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act is to raise the standards of policing in America and also to transform the culture.
The bill bans chokeholds and aims to combat racial profiling. It was named after George Floyd, an unarmed African American whose death last May triggered nationwide racial justice protests. A previous version of the bill had passed the House last year but languished in the then Republican-controlled Senate. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the legislation will not erase centuries of systematic racism and excessive policing in America, but takes a tremendous step towards stopping the violence. 46-year-old Floyd died when a white Minneapolis police officer pressed his knee on the victim's neck for more than 8 minutes. Iran's president says the United States has imposed an all-out economic war against his country.
The international community has witnessed an illegal approach and an all-out economic war imposed by the United States against the Islamic Republic of Iran over the past 4 years. These cruel sanctions have inflicted irreparable damage on the government and people of Iran.
Addressing the 14th summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization, Rouhani said the U.S. has failed to bring the Iranian nation to its knees. Rouhani called on Washington to lift all anti-Tehran sanctions and take practical measures to return to the 2015 nuclear deal. He said Tehran will reverse its commitment cuts if Washington returns to the agreement. Rouhani also called for a united international front against Washington's unilateral sanctions. The call was echoed by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan urged the U.S. to remove its sanctions and return to the Iran nuclear deal. He said the move would contribute to the region's stability and economic prosperity. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister has once again ruled out any renegotiation of the 2015 nuclear deal, urging mutual implementation of the pact. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif urged all parties to the pact to get down to implementing it instead of just posturing. Zarif was responding to Wendy Sherman, who has called for a stronger nuclear deal. Sherman, who is nominated by U.S. President Joe Biden for Deputy Secretary of State, argues that the facts on the ground have changed since the nuclear agreement was signed in 2015. Tehran says the only way to save the pact is for the U.S. to lift all its sanctions. Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says the European decision to stop, or to drop rather, an anti-Iran resolution at the agency's board meeting has helped avoid unnecessary tension. Hermeleski has the details.
Britain, France and Germany drop a resolution against Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said most board members agreed that now is not the time for a resolution criticizing Iran's cooperation with the agency. Tehran had warned the three European states the adoption of such a resolution would be interpreted as an end to the joint understanding between Iran and the IAEA reached more than a week ago, allowing the agency to continue with necessary verification work in the country. Gharibabadi said the E3 exercised a prudent approach by considering the consequences of their proposal.
We welcome such an approach by the Board of Governors and also the E3 countries, and it shows that the wisdom prevails, actually. And in my view, by stopping the process of pursuing this resolution, an unnecessary tension was prevented.
IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said Tehran had accepted his initiative to engage in a focused, systematic effort to clarify a number of outstanding issues.
We were able to have an understanding, and we are going to be starting this process of focused analysis of the situation with a technical meeting, which will take place in Iran the beginning of April, which I hope will be followed by other technical or political meetings as agreed by both sides.
Grossi said his intention is to come to a satisfactory outcome in time for the next regular session of the board next June. The agency says it wants to clarify questions concerning the presence of uranium particles at undeclared locations in Iran. Iran has already provided the agency with complementary access to three locations. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA says Tehran is also determined to resolve the remaining issues, although it does not believe in setting artificial deadlines. Homolezki, Vienna.
A new report suggests that poverty in Italy was dramatically on the rise last year. The report also said the COVID-19 crisis has exposed the vulnerability of the new poor in Italy. Max Giovidi reports.
Preliminary data released by the National Bureau of Statistics ISTAT shows that absolute poverty levels in Italy reached a 15-year high in 2020. Last year, the number of families facing absolute poverty climbed to 7.7% from 6.4% in 2019, translating into more than 2 million households not being able to afford the minimum standards of living, which include food, adequate shelter, and healthcare.
We had more than 1 million additional poor in 2020 compared to the year before. However, it must be said that growing poverty levels have also been recorded across all European countries and in the UK after the 2008 financial crisis. Italy has struggled to pick up from that downturn due to a fragmentation of anti-poverty policies and ineffective employment strategies.
Statistical body ISTAT also stressed that the monthly spending of the average Italian household dropped by almost 10%. Sent to about 2,300 euros last year, the lowest value since 2000.
Those without solid job contracts are the most exposed in the COVID-19 crisis that has already killed almost 100,000 people in Italy, the second highest death toll in Europe. Food security is emerging as a key issue for an increasing number of Italians.
The cost of living has risen to unbearable levels. My son used to work as a temporary employee in a restaurant. He has been jobless for months now. How long can we carry on this way?
The previous government hasn't helped Italy much. My daughter has been temporarily laid off, and her pay is now one-third of what it used to be.
Discontent among Italians is also growing over a much delayed vaccination campaign. So far, 1.5 million people, about 3% of the population only, have been inoculated with both COVID vaccine doses amid delays and disputes in the delivery schedule across the whole of the European Union. Max Civili, Rome.
Turning to other news now, Brazil's daily coronavirus infections rise by more than 75,000. A new high since July last year. The total COVID-19 cases have reached nearly 10.8 million. The Latin American country also recorded nearly 1,700 new fatalities, bringing the overall death toll to almost 261,000. That's while health authorities have warned that the emergence of new variants would worsen the situation as the country's vaccination program has been sluggish. Brazil has recorded the world's second highest virus-related deaths after the United States. The total number of fatalities in the U.S., the world's worst-hit country, has surpassed the 520,000 with over 28.8 million positive cases. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Researchers say the estimate of the number of corals published in the journal Nature Ecology and Evolution suggests there are as many corals in the Pacific Ocean as there are trees in the Amazon rainforest. We're prepared for an article written by Graham Redfern. The piece is titled New Study Finds As Many Corals Growing in Pacific as Trees in Amazon. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Graham Redfern's article. The world's first estimate of the number of corals across the expanse of the Pacific Ocean has suggested there are about 500 billion of the reef-building animals. Researchers say their findings from an analysis of more than 900 reef sites shows the risk of extinction of individual coral species is lower than current international assessment. The authors said the estimate of the number of corals published in the journal Nature Ecology and Evolution suggests there are as many corals in the Pacific Ocean as there are trees in the Amazon rainforest. A separate study revealed for the first time the rich biodiversity of little-known habitats on the sea floor between reefs in the north of the Great Barrier Reef that have existed since the end of the last ice age. Global heating is putting coral reef ecosystems around the world at risk, with Australia's Great Barrier Reef going through 3 mass bleaching episodes since 2016. Andy Didsel, who led the study estimating the number of corals, said the findings did not undermine concerns about the impacts of global heating on reef habitats, but did suggest concerns about the survival of individual coral species needed to be reconsidered. He said there was still a risk of extinctions occurring locally, and these could have devastating ecological impacts. Andy Didsel of the ARC Centre of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies at James Cook University in Australia said, "On the Great Barrier Reef, we have seen in the last 5 years a loss of so many corals that are sensitive to heat stress." He said, "Even though they may not go extinct in the next decade, they may decline by 95%, and they then lose the function that they've had on the ecosystem where they live. For example, we then lose the habitat for fish species." The study said local depletion of functionally important coral species may also trigger cascades of extinctions in associated organisms, long before the global extinction of the depleted coral species itself. The regions studied included about 70% of the global area of shallow water coral reefs, and more than 600 of the estimated 800 species of hard coral. The study looks at the population sizes of more than 318 species of coral reef and found that 17 were hyperdominant, with their numbers equaling the total of the remaining 301 species. The International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources, the IUCN, is the global authority on the conservation status of the world's species. According to the study, 80 of the species analyzed are listed by the International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources as having an elevated risk of extinction. But Andy Dietzel said their study had little agreement with the IUCN's list. Some 12 of the species listed by the IUCN as threatened had estimated populations of more than 1 million. Professor Terry Hughes, a co-author of the study, also at James Cook University in Australia, said there was a revision underway of coral species within the International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources, the IUCN. Professor Terry Hughes said, "As an ecologist, I'm more worried about local changes, and a coral could become so rare that it's effectively extinct, even if it hasn't disappeared off the face of the earth." His own estimates, based partly on the figures in the study, suggest that the Great Barrier Reef alone has tens of billions of corals. Some reef restoration projects focus on growing corals in aquarium settings and then replanting them on reefs. Professor Terry Hughes said, "The point is that there are still a lot of wild corals out there, and in my opinion, we should be aiming our effort at maintaining the surviving corals and helping them to regrow." He added, "We have to protect the wild corals rather than trying to substitute populations from what we can grow in a laboratory." For perspective, he said that 250 million adult corals represented only about 1% of the coral cover across the Great Barrier Reef. Another study, also released in the same journal, provides new insights into mysterious donut-shaped meadows that cover thousands of square kilometers of the ocean floor in between reefs in the northern section of the Great Barrier Reef. Queensland University of Technology researcher Mardi McNeil and colleagues have for the first time produced a biodiversity census of the plants and animals on these little-known habitats, built on the skeletons of an algae called Halimeda that populate them. Mardi McNeil said, "People are going over the top of them all the time to get to the reefs," adding, "but they've been growing out there since the end of the last ice age." According to the study, covering more than 6,000 square kilometers, the meadows are revealed as a magnet for more than 1,300 species of plants, invertebrates, plants, rare corals, and fish. McNeil said, "Diving on them is an amazing experience," adding, "As the Halimeda meadow starts to come into view, you can just see this carpet going out to the edge of your visibility." The meadows are about 25 meters down and are 250 to 300 meters across and 20 meters thick in some places. They're shaped like a donut with a depression in the center that can be 45 meters deep. For the study, McNeil gathered data from a major seafloor mapping project across the reef carried out in mid-2000s. McNeil said, "We're only just learning about the importance of this ecosystem, but it could be being changed by ocean heating and acidification. About 40% of the species found under Haliemada banks were not found on other areas of the sea floor. At 25 meters deep, the Haliemada are relatively dark, unknown and challenging to visit with scuba gear. McNeil said they've been growing out there since the end of the last ice age, when that part of the continental shelf flooded, adding, "But this is the first time anyone has put together a baseline census of the plants and animals living there." She hoped the research would encourage more scientists to study the Haliemada meadows and raise their profile in conservation efforts.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Welcome to your own show, A Muslim Lady, from IRIB English Radio. It's an honor for me to be here and to share with you the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Although we try to convey their message, the message of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, but I'm sure that our listeners also, they have studied these beautiful treatise of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the ahadith of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, which we discuss here. So it's a gently reminder for our listeners. And with me to share her knowledge is my wife, Razia Batul Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. As a wife, I'm here and we are going to discuss the rights of wife. So you can imagine that how happy I am that we are, as a student of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, we are just entering in the Institute of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, and we want to dig what kind of treasure Imam has left for us. And until now, I think we have done so many amazing points and messages from Imam, from this book of Risalatul Huquq,
the treatise of rights. So let's move on and continue the beautiful right of wife in the eyes of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, where Imam says that فَتَعْلَمْ أَنَّ ذَلِكَ نِعْمَةً مِّنَ اللَّهِ عَلَيْكَ فَتُكْرِمَهَا وَتُرْفِقَ بِهَا. We were talking about these beautiful two words, ikram and rifq. In our last episodes, we talked about ikram, about the honor, how you can honor your spouse, your wife or husband, your wife mostly, because we are talking about the rights of wife. So in today's episode, we will talk upon the turfiqa biha. You have to be very gentle. You have to treat her gently.
Wow. When you say gentle, I remember the saying of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Al-mar'atu rayhana laysat biqahramana. You know, like, treat her very gently, like a flower.
How we treat two flowers, you know, just we handle it with care and we take care of it very, very gently, you know.
Yeah.
Likewise, we have to be very gentle towards our wives.
Wives, yeah. So maybe in tukrimuha ikram, we are common. Like, we have to respect each other, definitely. But when it comes to rifq, you know, wife needs more rifq, more, yeah, you know, politeness. Because men, they are manifesting the jalal of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. Sometimes the they are very power, yeah, you know, a bit. Sometimes, you know, it looks like aggressiveness. So, and wives, they are manifesting the jamal of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala.
The beauty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Exactly.
And beauty needs a lot of care, you know. The soft thing needs more care and more, you know, attention. That's why always, you know, wives and ladies, they need more attention, more care. Even we can say that rifq means rifaqa, means friendly and friendship. The closeness between a husband and wife, you know. So again, if you be polite and if you are very gentle with your wife, you will become very, very close friend.
Yeah.
And
so it doesn't mean
if that, you are
yeah.
close friends, then there is no barrier between you and your husband. You know, you can share each up and down of your life with each other, and you can face all the problems together, and all together you can make your life peaceful.
Yeah, so it means, like, you know, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is giving this amazing, powerful statement that الرجال قوامون على النساء, you know, unfortunately we are taking very wrong meaning of this ayah, that men are superior and they have this controlling power over women. That is not right, you know. We are translating it very negatively. It means they
does
both
not mean
have,
they have
yeah.
to be the dominant
exactly.
you know, in their family and their
yeah,
house.
Their relationship based on rifaqat, you know, friendshipness. And definitely the duties are different, but the main thing is to understand each other, to respect each other, and to be gentle to each other.
So for this, yeah, again, Imam saying that we have to change our mentality, our mind. You know, marriage, you know, unfortunately nowadays in our societies, marriage means the dominance of husband.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
That's why whenever they talk about the rights of wife and husband, they give the priority to the rights of husband, you know. So they think that husband owns everything in their house. Husband owns wife. Everything belongs to their house. And his words and his sayings are the final words, final decision. And Islam totally condemns these things. Islam says the house and the family should be on the mutual basis. You know, you have to respect your wife. You have to give all your rights, all the rights which she deserves and which Islam has given to her. And in return, she will, you know, offer you the peace and tranquility which you are looking for. If you find this peace and tranquility in your life, then alhamdulillah, you will have a very, very fruitful and
yeah.
peaceful life.
One of the ways of expression of rifq and politeness is how to call each other, you
yeah.
know, the way we are naming each other.
Definitely you have to express, you know, rifaqa, rifq means you have to be gentle, and polite means you have to express your love, your, you know, feelings with your wife. You have to share and express. And Islam has emphasized upon these things, upon expressing, you know, your feelings with your wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that if your wife has any name, so you always just call upon her name. Look like Hadith Kisa, for example. Yeah, very famous hadith. So in that hadith, for example, Hazrat Zahra salamu alayha, she knows that her husband's name is Ali or her son's name is Hassan, yeah, alayhi salam. But she's not saying, oh, Hassan, She's saying, "O qurratu aini wa samaratu fuadi," apple of my eye, you know, joy of my heart. Oh, my cousin. Oh, my, you know, like peace, a source of peace.
Yeah, even so, taking the name itself, Ali, is ibadah.
Definitely.
She could easily say and take this name, Ali. But out of respect and love, she would always say,
Ya Ibn Am or Ya Abul Hassan. You know, it shows that you're like, she's teaching us until the day of Qiyamah that this is the principle, you know, of life in your marital life. Yeah.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
So inshallah, we have to think how we are calling each other as a spouse, not only name. Something should be there, whatever you feel comfortable.
But unfortunately, again, we can say that in our societies, not only they respect, not only they take their names, but sometimes they bully, you know, bully. They call each other by wrong names, by, you know, their faults, by their, you know, whatever.
It's really sad.
Yeah.
It's difficult to understand that those kind of people exist in this world, but that is the reality, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. So Islam encourages not only to take your husband's name, wife's name, but call them with beautiful nicknames, you know, which shows that you are expressing your love.
I would love to share this hadith. Amazing, amazing, amazing. That إِذَا أَرَادَ اللَّهُ بِأَهْلِ بَيْتٍ خَيْرًا رَزَقَهُمْ الرِّفْقِ فِي الْمَعِيشَةِ وَحُسْنُ الْخُلْقِ. So look at the translation. When Allah desires to show His goodness, you know, when Allah wants to treat very nicely to His servant, so what He will do, إِذَا أَرَادَ اللَّهُ بِأَهْلِ بَيْتٍ, especially to a family member.
Household.
Yeah, household. So for household, a special, special, special gift of Allah, when Allah is desiring to show His love, His special attention to that household, is رَزَقَهُمُ الرِّفْقُ. Allah will give them as a rizq, as a sustenance, rifq, politeness. You know, and that love, that compassionate, that, you know, that beautiful bond, you know, their hearts are together, they respect each other, they love each other, they are so much gentle to each other, their akhlaq is amazing. Look at the hadith, mashallah. And we are so far away from this, unfortunately.
And Islam especially emphasizes upon, you know, expressing by husband, you know. Islam says husband should express his love and his, you know, closeness to his wife. By expressing, he can get a very special status in the eyes of his wife. That's why this very famous hadith of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that قول الرجل للمرأة إني أحبك لا يذهب من قلبها أبدا, that whenever a husband says to his wife that I love you, this never goes away from her heart.
Subhanallah, subhanallah. Yeah. Amazing. Like, you know, literally, Imam is teaching us how to say, you know, look at our soul father, Aima alayhi salam, beautiful, mashallah.
They have given these golden, you know, statements to build a very, very peaceful environment. You know, usually if a husband loves, I know so many of my friends, they love their wives, but they do not express.
Why?
I don't know, because sometimes it goes to their society, their family, because they have been brought up, their culture, they do not express a lot, and sometimes they feel shy maybe expressing in their love towards their wives. But Islam says you have to express whatever feeling comes, positive feeling, you have to express to your wife. Definitely, this will increase the love and the respect between the husband and wife.
And one more hadith which I truly love is that Man Aasha Mudariya Mata Shahida.
Wow.
And if you have this great opportunity to live with compromisation, like you just compromise your spouse's mistakes, so the life with mudarat, with compromise, yeah, leads you towards that your death will count in the eyes of Allah as a martyrdom.
Oh,
you know, you can change your death to martyrdom by having a rifq and gentleness in your life.
Yeah. So always this time is bothering us and it runs very fast, unfortunately.
That is a part of life, yeah.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
When the verdict came, it reduced the Paris court to a stunned silence. Nicolas Sarkozy was guilty of corruption and influence peddling and sentenced to 3 years in prison, two of them suspended. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled "Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy Sentenced to Jail for Corruption." Stay with us for more of Kim Wilshire's article. When the verdict came, it reduced the Paris courtroom to a stunned silence. Nicolas Sarkozy was guilty of corruption and influence peddling and sentenced to 3 years in prison, two of them suspended. France as president from 2007 to 2012 had played an active role in forging a corruption pact with his lawyer and a senior magistrate to obtain information on a separate investigation into political donations, the leading judge declared, and there was serious and concurring evidence of collaboration between the three men to break the law. The conviction and sentence were dramatic, unexpected and historic. Nicolas Sarkozy, 66 years old, had repeatedly declared his innocence and dismissed the charges as an insult to my intelligence. It is, however, unlikely he will spend a day in jail. His lawyer has announced he intends to appeal the decision, a process that could lead to a new trial and a one-year prison sentence can be served outside of jail under certain conditions, including the wearing of an electronic bracelet or limited home confinement. Sarkozy did not comment as he left the courtroom, but his wife, the supermodel turned singer Carla Bruni, on Instagram described the verdict as an injustice. Quel acharnement insensé, mon amour. Le combat continue, la vérité fera jour, which translates as, what relentless nonsense, my love. The battle continues, the truth will out. And that was from Carla Bruni's official Instagram account. While Sarkozy was not banned from holding public office, the verdict delivered on Monday afternoon, 1st of March 2021, is likely to quash his hopes of returning to public life in time for next year's presidential elections in France. His centre-right Les Républicains Party, LR Party, has been struggling to come up with a credible candidate since Sarkozy's former Prime Minister, François Fillon, was engulfed in scandal during the 2017 presidential race, opening the way for the current president, Emmanuel Macron, to win. His trial last year, the court heard how Nicolas Sarkozy instructed his lawyer, Thierry Herzog, to offer the senior magistrate, Gilbert Azibert, a cushy job in the Côte d'Azur in return for information on an investigation into whether he had received donations from the ailing L'Oréal heiress, Liliane Bettencourt. The Bettencourt case was eventually dropped, but by then, an investigation into corruption and influence peddling had been opened. The judge, Christine May, the president of the tribunal, said there was serious evidence of a corruption pact between Nicolas Sarkozy, Thierry Herzog, and Gilbert Azibert. Herzog, age 65, and Azibert, 73, were given similar sentences of 3 years imprisonment, two of them suspended. The case, based on telephone taps, became known as the Bismuth Affair. Paul Bismuth was the name the former president Nicolas Sarkozy employed in connection to two burner telephones used to communicate with Thierry Herzog. French detectives began monitoring Sarkozy's communications in September of 2013 as part of an investigation into claims he had received an illegal and undeclared 50 million euro donation from the former Libyan strongman and dictator Muammar Gaddafi to fund his successful 2007 presidential campaign. What they heard, though, from the recorded conversations pointed investigators in a new and unexpected direction. They revealed the former president, Sarkozy, and his lawyer, Thierry Herzog, were secretly communicating using mobile telephones registered under false names. Additional wiretaps on these phones picked up conversations suggesting Sarkozy had been in contact with Gilbert Azibert, then a member of the Cour de Cassation, the highest court in France, via Thierry Herzog to request confidential information about the Lilian Betancourt case. Nicolas Sarkozy, who is embroiled in several legal cases, has repeatedly denied accusations of any wrongdoing in all past and present investigations. He spent years attempting to have the bismuth charges thrown out and the case dismissed. Thierry Herzog argued the secretly recorded conversations between him and former President Sarkozy were covered by client-lawyer privilege and could not be used as evidence. Before his trial last year, Nicolas Sarkozy had said he welcomed the hearing as a chance to clean my name. I am combative. I have no intention of being accused of things I haven't done. I'm not corrupt, and what has been inflicted on me is a scandal that will rest in the annals. The truth will out, Nicolas Sarkozy told BMF TV. The former French president is expected to appear in court later this month in yet another case, the Big Malian affair, in which he is accused of overspending on his 2012 re-election bid. Nicolas Sarkozy is also being investigated on allegations of influence peddling and laundering of crime and misdemeanor related to consulting activities in Russia. Sarkozy's supporters have accused French judges of making the former president the target of an unfair and relentless legal crusade. He's the first former president to appear in court on criminal charges. His predecessor, Jacques Chirac, was charged and convicted, received a 2-year suspended sentence over fake jobs at City Hall when he was the mayor of Paris, but was spared taking the stand in the courtroom because of ill health. At the end of his 2-week trial last year, Sarkozy said, "This case has been for me the stations of the cross, but if that was the price to pay for the truth to come out, I'm ready to accept it. I still have confidence in the justice of our country." His lawyer, Thierry Herzog, was also convicted of breaching the rules of professional secrecy between him and his client. Thierry Herzog and Gilbert Azibert have announced they will appeal the court's decision and they will appeal against their conviction. After the verdict, Damien Abad, the president of Les Républicains, or LR parliamentary group, tweeted, "Today I want to again express my friendship with President Nicolas Sarkozy. His life has been a succession of trials that he has never ceased to overcome with energy and courage. Once again, he will prove this. I'm certain of it."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.